Is the proposed Golden Dome missile defense system actually necessary to protect Canada and America from missiles launched by Russia and China? Can Prime Minister Mark Carney be persuaded to abandon the project even as an add-on to the North American Aerospace Defense Command? Why is Canada and the European Union states suddenly committing to boosting military spending at the expense of programs of social and environmental spending? What plans do the G7 leaders hope to hatch at their meeting in Kananaskis this weekend, and what can ordinary residents of Canada and the world do to fight back? Today on the Global Research News Hour, we are looking at plans by Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney to boost military spending to 2% of the GDP of his country in just a few months, and his apparent embrace of the unproven Golden Dome missile defense shield, and what stakes await Canadians who want to stop war, not start new ones, especially of a nuclear nature. In our first half hour, the scientist Theodore Postol of MIT joins us to explain why missile defense shield today, like missile defense in the 1980s, is more science fiction than science fact, and why alternatives would be far more preferable to this insanely expensive strategy. Then in our second half hour, we sit down with Tamara Lawrence of the Canadian Voice of Women for Peace to discuss the false vision of a more peaceful world through increasing and expensive military strength and how to refute these claims in Canada. Finally, Alberta organizer Morgan Johnson, representing the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network, explains what is wrong with the G7 leaders meeting in his province this weekend and about the activities pushing back against an agenda not in the interest of the Canadian or the world's people. On this week's program, welfare, not warfare. Stop Golden Dome. Reduce military spending. Resist the G7 summit. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 13th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States, and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The abundance of the land and waters are to be shared. When we as settlers recognize the truths of history and the privileges we have enjoyed in the wake of the economic and social structures created through that history, we must acknowledge the responsibility of making things right and being accountable to each other. Let us begin to correct the injustices toward all the Indigenous people through reconciliation and reparations and arrive at a better partnership between both our peoples. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. Trump's strong anti-immigration policies have been one of the central points of his presidential campaign, so it's only expected that he'd want to make sure that at least those provinces are kept. On the other hand, illegal immigrants are a big part of the DNC's agenda in the U.S., so their support for the riots is expected. However, Trump's troubles aren't only with the Democrats and parts of the deep state that still oppose him. Namely, there's also the ongoing spat with Elon Musk, one of his closest allies during the presidential campaign. The eccentric billionaire has been very public about America's debt, a disaster in the making that now costs the belligerent thalassocracy more than its yearly military budget in interest alone. That comes from the article, Los Angeles Riots, Trump-Musk Spat, Will Crisis in America Escalate? Drago Bosnick, by Drago Bosnick, posted June 11th, originally published on InfoBricks. Russia has not yet reacted. President Putin wants to avoid a world war. It is uncertain what form a WW3 would take, full nuclear, tactical nuclear, or state-of-the-art conventional, with results as devastating as nuclear, but without the radiation. Where is the final red line? Nobody knows. That comes from the article, Russia Under Drone Attack. When is it enough? Enough. Quote, where is the final red line? What is next? Unquote. Peter Koenig. By Peter Koenig, posted June 11th. ACIP has not functioned as a true scientific body. For decades, it has served as an automated rubber stamper operated by the biopharmaceutical complex. Since 2020, this troubling reality has only been reinforced by ACIP's reckless recommendations of COVID-19 mRNA shots, which have resulted in mass injury and death. For the first time in a generation, there is hope that U.S. vaccine policy may finally be shaped by independent experts who put public safety before profit. If you're curious as to what an ACIP meeting can look like, I recommend that you watch the following clip from 2018 where they rubber stamp the hepatitis B vaccine. That comes from the article, Decades of Corruption. Congressional report confirms CDC's ACIP has been compromised since the 1990s. By Nicholas Hulsher, posted June 11th, originally published on Focal Points. This is martial law without a formal declaration of war. This heavy-handed, chest-thumping, politicized, militarized response to what is clearly a matter for local government is yet another example of Trump's disregard for the Constitution and the limits of his power. Political protests are protected by the First Amendment until they cross the line from nonviolent to violent. Even when protests turn violent, constitutional protocols remain for safeguarding communities. Law and order must flow through local and state chains of command, not from federal muscle. By breaking that chain of command, Trump is breaking the Constitution. That comes from the article, The Spectacle of a U.S. Police State. This is martial law against Americans without a formal declaration of war. By John W. Whitehead and Nisha Whitehead, posted June 11th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Prime Minister Mark Carney confirmed to the press on May 21st that he and senior officials are having talks with the Trump administration about joining the Golden Dome missile defense program, a project with a price tag of $175 billion would involve having both ground and space-based weapons to detect and stop missiles during the four stages of them from being launched, from liftoff to descending towards the target. The systems would involve the construction and placement of hundreds of satellites in low Earth orbit. It would also involve the work of modernizing the North American Air Defense Command, or NORAD, to which Canada has already committed over $38 billion in the near future. The Golden Dome is purported to be completed by 2029, so just in 3 years' time. There is also a significant criticism of this project, and we are delighted to have with us today an outspoken scientist who has been a critic and skeptic of American weaponry proposals for decades. Theodore A. Postol is Professor Emeritus of Science, Technology, and National Security Policy in the Program of Science,
Technology and Society at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He went to the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment to study methods of basing the MX missile and later worked as a scientific advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations. His work for the chief related to the strategic submarine and anti-submarine warfare, targeting of U.S. nuclear weapons, Soviet ballistic missile defense systems, U.S. anti-ballistic missile defense countermeasure systems for the Trident II ballistic missile, and other matters related to the strategic nuclear technologies and policies. He also acted as a key technical and policy advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations on matters related to national decision-making by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Among his work, Postol criticized the U.S. government's analysis of the 2013 Ghouta chemical attack in Syria, the attack by the U.S. and other Western governments of the 2017 Khan Seikhoun chemical attack, and accused the OPCW of deception concerning the Douma chemical attack. He also criticized the U.S. government statements about the reported success rates of Patriot missiles during the first Gulf War and spoke about the exaggerations in a Pentagon advisory board that exaggerated the capabilities of an anti-ballistic missile sensor. And among other awards, he is the recipient of the 1995 Killiard Roderick Prize in Science, Arms Control, and International Security from the American Association for the Advancement of Science for outstanding contributions that advance our understanding of issues related to arms control and international security that have important scientific or technical dimensions. Professor Postol joins us now to talk about the Golden Dome Project. It is a pleasure to have you join us, Ted Postol. Thank you and welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Michael, and I greatly appreciate you taking the effort to bring me in.
Professor Postol, based on what has been announced to the public so far, what flaws have you spotted in the ability, even of an insanely expensive system, to ever outsmart a major technical adversary like Russia or China launching missiles at us?
Well, perhaps I should start by saying that the claims that were that are being made by the Trump administration with regard to this system are, I would say, total fictions. My only guess as to why they are doing it is that it is something designed to play to their political base. If you really believed that you could do something like this, I want to underscore, if you really believed it and had done any elementary work on this, you'd know, for example, that a few hundred satellites, if you could make them work, I wonder, that's another important thing, but let's assume you could make those satellites workable against ICBMs launched from the surface of the Earth. You would need between 1,500 and 2,000 of them in orbit if you were going to be able to engage a single ICBM launched from anywhere on the surface, from the surface of the Earth. So that assumes you have, I'll be specific, I've done the analysis. You know, you'd have the satellites in an orbit at 400 kilometers. You'd each satellite would have a single interceptor on it with maybe a 5 kilometer per second burnout speed. And this is based on, you know, serious technical analysis. So a baseline would be 1,500 satellites carrying a single 5 kilometer per second burnout speed interceptor. That's to be able to engage a single ICBM launch from anywhere on the Earth. If you wanted to engage, for example, a mass launch, which would be localized, so the satellites would be spread out, but the launch would be from a small area on the surface of the Earth, you'd need to increase the size of the constellation by 100, if there were 100, if the mass launch were, let's say, postulated to be 100 ICBMs simultaneously, and that would require 150 to 200,000 satellites in orbit, not hundreds of satellites, but hundreds of thousands of satellites. So the idea that you could even launch that much mass into orbit, assuming the mass were just bags of dirt, is well beyond any possibility of given the resources available for launching things into space. So this is just a technical joke.
Well,
Is
they also, I mean, I imagine the response on the part of the, I guess the Russians would be if we build this shield, the way of outsmarting it is to send even more missiles than we could, so that, a certain proportion will get through, especially also considering they're hypersonic and can, deviate in all kinds of different directions from the ballistic missile trajectory.
Well, the simplest way, well, I don't know if it's the simplest way, but one of the simple ways, there are many ways to defeat this. But for every additional missile, you can add to an advanced launch. I mean, to a launch that's a bunch of missiles together. For every missile that you would add, an ICBM you would add, the United States to counter it would have to add between 1,500 and 2,000 satellites to a constellation that would already be hundreds of th thousands of satellites in size in order to deal with a mass launch. I mean, this is a no-win situation at the arithmetic level, assuming, of course, that the technology works. I want to underscore that the technology is not proven, but assuming it works, they're just the numbers are astounding. And of course, if you were to talk, if you would do s just a simple, the most simple arithmetic estimates of the costs of launching such a system, assuming you could build it again and launch it, you're talking about many trillions of dollars, not $175 billion. That's nothing. That's not even a pinprick. For putting a system like this in place. So I would say that the Canadian leadership needs to have its scientific staff advise them on what the reality of this system is. And if they want their technical staff to contact me and I can provide them with references to analysis, I'd be happy to do that. Canadians certainly have a scientific establishment that's well up to the job of verifying what I just said here, and if they haven't already done so, which would not surprise me. But it's really important that political leaders get advice from the scientific and technical people who work for them. I mean, this is a failure of responsibility on the part of Canadian political leadership if they go ahead with an agreement when without consulting their own experts who are more than up to the job of providing them accurate information. I'm a little bit on a campaign here because my I having watched the situation politically over the last few years, I have really gotten into a mindset of blaming our political leaders in the West, which includes not only the American political leadership, but Western Europe and Canada, for not doing their homework. You know, you're in a job that's responsible, and in order to do that job responsibly, you need to have information. And if you're not getting that information and you're making decisions without finding that information, then I'm afraid I would have to say you are not serving the Canadian people well. You are doing a disservice to the American, to the Canadian people.
Well,
And
I mentioned that this project is intended to be actually an extension of NORAD to which we have been committed for decades. But a lot of members of government are actually saying that they aren't crazy about this Golden Dome ballistic missile defense system. I guess you've been a scientific advisor to the Canadian government before on
well, not
the
real. I've been asked to speak to the parliament, and I have. Yes.
yeah. So I guess I have to ask, I mean, what key points that, I mean, you talk about being, scientifically accurate, but I mean, you also have to consider that, this government, they're sort of in a position of having Donald Trump holding this, tariff axe over our heads. So, I mean, even if they know it's not, feasible, is it, is this sort of a maneuver they've got to make in order to keep them, on side? I mean, how, because I mean, if they don't, then they would just attack. I mean, that seems to
Well,
be his style.
I mean, first of all, I'm not a Canadian citizen, so I feel very reserved about providing advice about what they should do. But I will say that the people in leadership roles have been put in those positions by the Canadian public, the Canadian citizens, citizenship, to make informed and well-founded decisions in support of Canadian national security. And I would say if they can't figure out a strategy that doesn't compromise Canadian national security, which I think blindly going along with this could have that effect, I won't say it will, then I think the Canadian electorate has to think about new leadership. That's we have this problem in the United States. My own, I'm not ideologically opposed to Donald Trump, but I am opposed to irrational decisions that hurt the nation. This is not the only policy position President Trump has taken that I believe hurts the national security of the United States. I say this without malice toward him or his administration. I just simply say, as a person who has expertise on national security matters, I think this is a very bad idea. I think this will hurt certainly the national security of the United States, and it will actually be vastly. I can't understand this, underscore this enough, vastly destabilizing. And let me explain why this is destabilizing. The first satellites that have interceptors on them that are launched will have an anti-satellite capability that has not yet been seen from any of the countries in the spacefaring countries in the world, Russia, China, United States. By putting these interceptors in orbit, these satellite interceptors that are supposed to attack ICBMs, those interceptors will have a better capability to intercept high-altitude satellites that have never before been reachable with anti-satellite systems. That is to say, a few dozens of satellites, not hundreds or thousands. So the process of launching this system would introduce grave instabilities internationally. A few dozens of these satellites would have interceptors on them that could attack, in theory and reality, all satellites in what are called geosynchronous orbits. And all of the navigational satellites in semi-synchronous orbits, these are the satellites called GPS and the Russian version called GLONASS. Now, those particular satellites, which have not yet been threatened by any any anti-satellite capability deployed by any nation would contain critical, absolutely sensitive early warning communication systems and navigation systems that are at the heart of the national security capabilities of China, Russia, and the United States. If anybody thinks that these countries are going to stand by and not do anything about this, I think they are sadly mistaken. And this is going to violate the treaty, the Outer Space Treaty, that says that you cannot have, you cannot put weapons in space to attack satellites. And this will create reactions that I cannot even begin to predict from at least the Chinese and Russians, and possibly even the Europeans, that will cascade into an international crisis. So this is not a minor issue. So this is beyond the question of expense, which of course is well beyond the capabilities of even the United States to do, and capabilities, which launch capabilities, which the United States simply does not have and can certainly not build in 3 years. I mean, it's just a joke. So we're getting back to a situation as unrealistic as the Strategic Defense Initiative was when it was first deployed. And I might add that I was in the Pentagon and an advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations when that absolutely reckless, crazy, and hallucinogenic idea was being put forth. And my boss, the Chief of Naval Operations, was part of a reckless process that led to the president announcing that we were going to go ahead with the Strategic Defense Initiative. So I witnessed firsthand the reckless ignorance of top political leadership in the case of the Strategic Defense Initiative. And this is exactly what's going on again here.
You just got about a minute left, but I
Sure.
mean, would you propose a counter solution to the problem of growing tensions between the United States and Canada and the so-called enemy states, Russia and China, especially now with a threatened attack from Russia in response to a Ukrainian attack on certain aircraft?
Well, I think that the United States has to take a hands-off attitude toward Russia. We have to stop trying to find ways to threaten the Russians. They are not intimidated by this. I want to underscore this. Your average listener does not know this, but I will state this unambiguously because your press, and when I say your press, I mean my press as well, has not done its job informing the populations of the United States and Canada, but they do not, that Russia has won the war in Ukraine hands down. And what we're going to see in the next few months is them cleaning up the situation and completely negating the Ukrainian government as a threat to Russia. So that's going to happen. That's in the process of happening. And unfortunately, our press, I consider Canada a very close and intimate ally of the United States. Our press has done a disservice to both our democracies. But we need to take a hands-off attitude toward Russia because Russia is going to do what it needs to protect itself from these aggressions on the part of the West. And people who are interested enough in this, you may want to have another discussion with me about it. But these aggressions are causing the Russians to arm themselves, and they are doing a very good job. They can outproduce the West in military equipment now, and I do not think they have any intentions of going after the West militarily, but they will negate anything the West tries to do to them, and they are in a position to do so.
Professor Postol, I'm really pleased to have finally had the chance to talk to you. Take care, and if you have the chance, maybe you can come to Parliament and offer your views again.
Well, I have to be invited.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Theodore.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye bye.
Award-winning scientist Theodore Postel is a professor emeritus of science, technology, and national security policy in the program in science, technology, and society at MIT, and he joined us from Boston, Massachusetts.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
So, for more on the Canada defense spending plans and this sudden devotion to militarism, we're joined by the peace activist Tamara Lawrence. Tamara Lawrence is he's a longtime member of the Canadian Voice of Women for Peace. Tamara is also a member of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom Canada. As well, she is on the advisory committee on the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, World Beyond War, and the No to War, No to NATO network. And Tamara is currently a PhD candidate at the Balsillie School of International Affairs at Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Ontario. Welcome back to the show, Tamara.
Thank you very much, Michael, for having me back.
So just last Monday, there was an announcement that Canada would be bulking up spending on defense to 2% of GDP within the year, double what it was in 2014 under Stephen Harper. Your reaction to that news?
This is a terrible announcement from our new prime minister. So this is a plan to rebuild, rearm, and reinvest in the Canadian Armed Forces. And it means that Canada is going to, in this next budget cycle, increase our military spending to 2% of GDP. The plan was under the previous Liberal government was to meet that 2% target by 2032. We are currently at 1.4% of GDP, which is $41 billion that we're spending on the Department of National Defense. Now going to 2% over the next years means an immediate investment of an additional $9 billion and going to a military spending annually of approximately $60 billion, and it will continue to go up. Because what we are also expecting is that Carney, when he goes to the NATO summit in 2 weeks, that he will also agree to the 5% NATO target in the next decade. So over the next 10 years, Canadians are going to be faced with the serious problem of our military spending rapidly increasing, and it's going to mean cutting social programs and environmental programs. So it's extremely reckless and irresponsible.
So yeah, so I mean, what are the specific social spending programs in place that are going to suffer as a result of this diversion of spending?
Well, maybe just before I mentioned that the threats to social spending, I should just go back to say that, you know, what we are doing with this, all this military spending, is we're going to be investing in new fossil fuel powered weapon systems. So combat aircraft, armed drones, more light armored vehicles, recruiting more soldiers, more military infrastructure, reinforcing our ports and roads. And what we are really doing by investing so much more in the military is preparing for war. So Canadians need to be extremely concerned the direction that our country is going, rapidly remilitarizing and preparing for war with against China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. And this has been outlined this week by the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. And in Mark Rutte's speech, the Secretary General's speech in London for the Chatham House on Monday, he said that the citizens of the NATO countries need to confront the reality that they are going to have less pensions and less social welfare programs because the priority is this militarism. And there are serious opportunity costs with spending on the military. Canadians will be faced with lower pension from the federal government, less provincial transfer payments. The federal government supports the provinces with university funding and with hospital funding, Medicare funding, and those will be on the line. That will be cut. The other thing is the child benefit. In Carney's speech from the throne, he never even said the word youth, and there was barely a mention of children in this. So they are prioritizing the military, the Canadian Armed Forces, instead of the well-being of Canadians, particularly children and youth. So if Canadians are concerned about this, they need to speak up now. They need to start putting pressure on their members of parliament and saying, this is not the direction that that Canada should go. We need to support peace, and we need to invest in the real priorities of Canadians, which is healthcare, education, housing, and the environment and the climate.
Why do you think Prime Minister Carney waited until this moment, not just before the NATO meeting at the end of the month, but before the G7 meeting at the end of this week?
Well, because the G7, which is a grouping of seven countries, plus the European Commission, the G7 is an economic grouping that is dominated by the United States. And then that conference, like you said, that summit, G7 summit, is coming up in Kananaskis, in Alberta, in just a few days. And then following that will be the big NATO summit in The Hague, in the Netherlands. And NATO, of course, is the military alliance of 32 North American and European states that again is dominated by the United States. And so Carney made this announcement this week in anticipation of those two meetings to signal to the United States that Canada is going to play ball in terms of the military. We are going to increase our military spending as the US and NATO want. And we've also made a priority on securing critical mineral supply. Canada has a lot of critical minerals, and quite frankly, why we need those critical minerals is because we're also ramping up weapons production. And that's very clear if you look at the NATO statements and if you look at the statements that are coming from the Canadian government and the US government. So we are preparing for war. This is extremely dangerous. And it's something that needs to be talked about honestly in the public and also on Parliament Hill. And this is something that we need to urgently stop.
Yeah, you said something interesting just because Europe is also bulking up their military spending to the disadvantage of their social programs. And I mean, you say a new war, I mean, possibly even a world war? Or is there some other function to building up funding for defensive purposes, I guess, under this military-industrial complex?
Michael, I'm glad that you mentioned about the rearmament of Europe. And that's right. Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, she announced this 800 billion euro program called Rearm Europe. And our prime minister, Mark Carney, already has articulated an interest by Canada participating in that European militarization program. And that's because we've got a very strong aerospace and defense and securities industry in this country, a very strong CADC lobby that want to have a piece of all of that weapon military spending for the manufacturing of weapons. But this is going to lock us into carbon intensive militarism for the next decades. This is going to prevent us from achieving the Paris Agreement and the UN Sustainable Development Goals over this crucial decade, where we need to make to meet those commitments so that we have a safe climate and a safe planet. And instead, we're preparing for a global war. That's exactly right. And I would just urge people, if they find this shocking, listen to the Senate hearing by U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Listen to the speech, for instance, that the U.S. Secretary of Defense Peter Hegseth just gave in Singapore at the Shangri-La Dialogue. They articulate a vision for a global war, a war against China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, using proxies of Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. And Canada is playing along with this, but we're using this liberal veneer that masks what we're really doing behind the scenes. So it's really crucial for us to do this investigation about what our government is really up to.
They say welfare, not warfare. I mean, that's a slogan of activists that I've heard. What is the general public not? I mean, they're not hearing that very much from the media. But I mean, are they on side with that, or are they on side with the idea of, yeah, we're going to war? I mean, because we were supposed to be a democracy, right? So why is this? What's a? This is a. We're at a bit of an impasse, right?
Well, there is a serious problem across all of the NATO countries, and you can see it very clearly in Canada with our mainstream media completely shutting out peace voices. So the CBC no longer interviews anybody in the peace movement. They don't even have include a peace perspective in any of their reporting, for instance, on the big arms fair, CANSEC, on the big defense. The big defense announcements, they completely ignore the peace alternative, the anti-war perspective. So the general public in this country is not getting the alternative views. And the fact that there are Canadians across the country that are mobilizing to try to stop this militarization, that are denouncing the increase to military spending. And it's not just happening in Canada, it's also happening in Europe. There's big demonstrations in the UK, like you said, welfare over warfare. This is being led by the Stop the War Coalition UK and the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. We have also seen huge protests in France and in Italy and even in Germany and many other countries. There are these huge protests. And right now there's a coalition of peace groups and anti-war groups that have come together to organize a huge counter summit against the big NATO summit that will be taking place in The Hague, in the Netherlands, June 24th and 25th. So there's going to be a massive protest there. There's going to be a peace summit to counter NATO. And we are all in unison calling for NATO to be abolished and for all of our countries to stop this militarism and to work collaboratively and cooperatively through the United Nations system, because that is the system that can really help us achieve climate security and sustainable development.
I appreciate that, but I was wondering, is there anything else you would like for people who aren't able to make it out of any of these demonstrations, or even those who do? What would you stress regarding the pushback? I mean, could Carney or the European states or both change their mind about defense spending, even if the powers that be seem connected to the, as I say, the military-industrial complex? What more can we do?
Well, we need to do a lot. We need to do everything that we can, because the future for our children and our grandchildren and having a safe environment is really at stake. So people need to do what they can. They need to contact their members of parliament. to say we don't want this increase to military spending. We don't want Canada to participate in Golden Dome. We don't want Canada to buy a new fleet of F-35 fighter jets. We need instead investments in public transit, high-speed rail, housing, healthcare, and education. We want Canada to get out of NATO. And we are building a national movement through the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network to call for Canada to withdraw from the US-led nuclear-armed military alliance. And the movement also exists in Europe. There are many activists across Europe who are calling for the disbanding of NATO. So whatever you can do, writing letters to the editor, contacting your member of parliament, joining a peace group, connecting with the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network, that would be really fantastic. Whatever you feel compelled to do, please do it, because it's going to take public pressure to stop this. But we succeeded 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we led a national movement to keep Canada out of U.S. ballistic missile defense. It was Canadian public pressure that stopped Canada from joining the Coalition of the Willing in the war in Iraq. So again, it will require public pressure to say we want peace, not war and military spending.
Yeah, so it's just like that government that was in power at the time. I mean, the current government is a liberal government, and I've heard several liberals speaking out in opposition to the Golden Dome, and I think they do tend to have a bit of a peace orientation, or at least more peaceful than what we're seeing from Carney right now. Tamara Lawrence, it's great to have you back. Thank you so much for this information, and I guess we're looking forward to what happens in the coming weeks. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Michael.
Tamara Lawrence, a longtime member of the Canadian Voice of Women for Peace and a member of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom Canada. The G7 summit is arriving in Alberta as this show goes to air to discuss the major targets of their agenda in the months and year ahead. There's also a counter summit of and pushback from Canadians who disagree with their plans and want the G7 countries to stop serving the ruling class and instead attend to the needs of the working class. Resist the Genocidal Seven, as it's called, is the name. And it refers to events happening over the next few days. And joining us to talk about it briefly is Morgan Johnson. He's a member of the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network, and he's also a regular journalist for the Canadian Canada Files, and he's helping organize the weekend events in opposition to the G7. Good afternoon, Morgan. Thank you for joining us on the Global Research News Hour. The counter events are organized by the International League of People's Struggle in Canada. Can you just briefly outline, you know, how that long this group has been in existence and other major actions that they have participated in the last year or so?
Hi, Michael. It's a real honor to be invited on to talk with you today. The international situation is so abominable at this moment. ILPS is a somewhat of a new group. They're mostly focused on migrant rights, but they are focusing also on the G7 and opposing militarization and war. So in the Alberta area, there are two actions. I just learned about the other one the other day, that there is also a rally happening in Banff. So in Calgary, I believe this Sunday, around noon at City Hall, there will be a rally. I highly recommend that regular people get involved. Anyone of any ideology, I think people really need to realize what is at stake in Canada's foreign policy and issues that are taking place around the world. The event happening in Banff is very similar. It looks to be more focused on climate, whereas the one in Calgary is more generally against the G7. So the one in Banff is occurring, I just want to pull it up here, noon on June 16th. That's at the Fenlands Center in Banff. The one in Calgary is the day before. So that would be Calgary City Hall, Sunday, June 15th, 1:30 p.m.
Could you talk a little bit about the key concerns that you are trying to bring forward that hopefully people will get out of it, if your protest is successful?
Oh, for sure. I can definitely speak more as a member of the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network. Our website has a statement out on that topic, and we've just concluded a webinar, which people can go back and watch the replay on the Facebook page. I would describe the G7 as a fortress of globalization. At this time, it's really important to get around the placating of its appearance and its innocent intents. The G7 operates like an economic bloc equivalent to the NATO military bloc. If NATO is a fortress of imperialism, the G7 is a fortress of globalization, and it is not focused on international governance, responsibility, or cooperation at all. It is an exclusive political club of elites in which they have promoted themselves as a meeting of democracies while operating against the principles of cooperation and democracy by bypassing international governance dedicated to real principles, such as the UN and many others. They have no legal mandate under international law. The G7 began in 1975 as an informal gathering of leaders of the capitalist nations as the Bretton Woods monetary system had collapsed and as globalized neoliberal capital rose up as the dominant economic ideology around the world. And so at this time in Alberta, particularly in Kananaskis, we are going to be seeing a meeting of those seven partners, while also Mark Carney has invited President Zelensky to attend as a delegate. So we're going to be seeing massive commitments and rhetoric around increasing militarization, embroiling the world in war and debt. So financializing those wars as well.
Okay, so you have a peaceful march starting on at Cal at City Hall at was it 1 o'clock in the afternoon? And then there is also a counter summit. It's an all-day discussion on Saturday. Could you talk a little bit about who the major speakers are during that event?
Actually, the announcement has not gone out yet, and I'm going to speak mostly as a member of Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network. We've endorsed all of these actions on Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. And so on Saturday, there will be a counter summit on the poster, of course, and as well, you can go to ILPS Canada. They have an Instagram page or their website to find the registration link for the People's Forum, or it's a counter summit. There is a registration link, and then as you register, they will disclose the location of that talk. I definitely suggest everyone gets involved in foreign policy matters. Whether you're independent or regardless of ideology, then of course on the Sunday the rally begins at City Hall. There are actions taking place earlier that day with other groups on all kinds of issues like water or indigenous issues, but the march begins at 1:30 p.m. I believe that other actions happening earlier in that day are at the Calgary City Hall in the same location. So there's actually no crossover or contradiction. You can literally just stick around if you're attending other things. And then by 1:30, people will be beginning to focus on the G7. And then, of course, on the Monday, that is the Banff G7 protest, Canada is on fire. That is taking place at noon at the Fenlands Centre in Banff.
And just maybe a brief remark about the media typically does not do an accurate job of representing your what you're all about. In fact, they might take, say, something like a Palestine demonstration, say, well, they hate Palestine, they hate Israel or something like that. What kind of a strategy do you have to address, the way the media may try to misrepresent you?
Well, it's rough out there. I would
Yeah.
say that it's so deplorable at this time. The international situation is an abomination. The last few years have been such a disgrace that I would say that humanity won't survive unless we break through. We have got to get independent views into people's attention span any way we can. And really, I don't have any concrete views whether the establishment mainstream media were to change their tune or if independent media is to replace legacy media. At the end of the day, what is most important is our actually existing civil liberties, like a right to our free mind, a right to freedom of expression, and a right to free association, so political association that we can vote however we want or associate however we want. Those are so critical in resisting this onslaught of lockdown, of independent views and propagation of propaganda that just is not working.
Okay, and finally, is there a website or a social media tag for those of us who just cannot make it down there as much as we might like to?
Not really. There's actually so many things happening that I would say it's actually quite difficult at this time to plug in and cooperate among different ideologies and groups. In Canada, I would say the peace movement is generally left wing, whereas historically, or in other countries, matters of international importance are nonpartisan because every country has a different government and every country has a different nation with different views and different conditions. So it is difficult in Canada. I would say that the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network is, pretty good for plugging everybody in beyond ideology. In terms of the local actions that are taking place, the Banff G7 protest, I'm not actually sure. They do have a email address. Otherwise, I have a poster. I don't actually know them
Okay.
super well. In Calgary, it's ILPS, and you can Google them, ILPS Canada, and then their Instagram page has the poster. They have a little QR code on the poster that brings you to the registration link as well.
Okay, well, sounds exciting. Sounds like a challenge. So good luck. Hopefully the G7 will catch a message of this in some form. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take
We've been
care.
speaking to Morgan Johnson, a journalist and organizer with the Anti-G7 events happening in Alberta over the next few days.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show can air on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download on the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.